listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Connor Coulson. This is Minute 79. This minute begins with David asking Shaw, "Have you and Dr. Holloway had any intimate contact recently?" and ends with Shaw getting up from the bed in an attempt to see what is growing inside of her. I was going to cover this in the last minute but ran out of time, expanding further on the relationship between the Xenomorph and Fire. Giving the aliens this weakness was probably just a practical consideration. You can't shoot or cut this creature, especially not in a spaceship. Its blood is profoundly acidic. Visually, a flamethrower also looks dramatic, but now I can't help but relate that imagery to an early modern human waving a flaming torch in the darkness to ward off predators. Having read the early scripts for Alien and delving into the production, it doesn't appear that the use of fire had any deeper significance, at least not intentionally. As discussed in the previous minute, context and meaning are mutable, especially in this instance where we have retroactive continuity in the form of the prequels. Having written some stories myself, it is fascinating when I hear back from readers these connections or symbolism, or they interpret this metaphor that I never intended, and then when they point it out, I go, "Oh, right, yeah, that, yep, yes, I meant that. That was definitely intentional." So having been in that situation, I can say there is this sense of, "Oh, I didn't think about it consciously, but I guess I must have known about that, or this idea had been culturally infused in me via osmosis." It's that same thing where it's sort of this, like a word test or a word puzzle where someone tells you a story about someone goes to see a doctor and whatever, but it's supposed to test your gender bias, because most people, if they're not paying attention, they'll just go, "Oh, the doctor was male, right? No, it was a female doctor." But having grown up with Star Trek The Next Generation, I tend to be like, Crusher or Pulaski? So either way, it is playing on your personal or cultural biases or preconceived notions. So that's why I think there is a case to be made that maybe there is something behind the choice of fire. Why gravitate to that more than any other weapon? It's not like that was the only option, but it just makes sense to go with a flamethrower on this subconscious level. Who is Prometheus? As covered in Minute 10, he created humanity, but he also stole fire from the gods to protect them. There is no such figure in this movie, at least not literally. But the name is very evocative of the themes of the film anyway, and we might say that's all there is to it. Engineers created us, but they certainly didn't steal fire for our benefit. Unless you want to go with the reading that there are other beings possibly more powerful than the engineers and they stole the mutagen from them, but that's going into wild speculation territory. It's all the more complicated because in Greek mythology, mankind was made by a titan, a race that was later superseded by the gods. Where most modern, specifically Western religions, are monotheistic, this is the rhetoric that filters into our popular culture. God and the divine creator are synonymous concepts, which is definitely not the case, especially with the Greek pantheon. Everyone has their own very specific roles. The notion that a god also has to be who created you is a relatively, I guess you could say, modern concept. And I come back to that a lot when I engage in that discussion of, do you believe in a god? And I am quite agnostic because I go, well, what are you defining as a god? Because the universe is infinite, and it stretches across a huge amount of time, so the chances are, oh, and let's not forget, there might also be a multiverse. So the chances of some being out there that did exist, does exist, or will one day exist, that is superior to humanity seems quite likely. I mean, there are many animals that are arguably superior to humanity in some ways. All hail the tardigrade. So I do subscribe to this idea that there may very well be aliens out there that are far beyond anything we can comprehend. Does that make them a god? It's up to you, really. What do you define as a god? Because I don't think they necessarily have to have created you. You know, let's go with your typical alien scenario. They can travel vast distances in an impossibly short amount of time. So are they the gods of exceeding light speed? You know, what are we defining as gods here? So in that sense, it does seem like the engineers fit into that definition of a god. But in Prometheus, the allegory refers more to man's hubris, reach exceeding grasp and what have you, trying to steal that fire for ourselves.
T.E. Lawrence, eponymously of Arabia, but very much an Englishman, favored pinching a burning match between his fingers to put it out. When asked by his colleague, William Potter, to reveal his trick, how is it he so effectively extinguished the flame without hurting himself whatsoever? Lawrence just smiled and said, "The trick, Potter, is not minding it hurts." The fire that danced at the end of that match was a gift from the Titan Prometheus, a gift that he stole from the gods when Prometheus was caught and brought to justice for his theft. The gods, well, you might say they overreact a little. The poor man was tied to a rock as an eagle ripped through his belly and ate his liver over and over, day after day, ad infinitum. All because he gave us fire, our first true piece of technology. Fire. 100,000 BC, stone tools. 4,000 BC, the wheel. 9th century AD, gunpowder. Bit of a game changer, that one. 19th century, Eureka, the light bulb. 20th century, the automobile, television, nuclear weapons, spacecraft, internet. 21st century, biotech, nanotech, fusion and fission and M-theory. And that was just the first decade. We are now 3 months into the year of our Lord, 2023. At this moment in our civilization, we can create cybernetic individuals who, in just a few short years, will be completely indistinguishable from us. Which leads to an obvious conclusion. We are the gods now. For those of you who know me, you will be aware by now that my ambition is unlimited. You know that I will settle for nothing short of greatness, or I will die trying. For those of you who do not yet know me, allow me to introduce myself. My name is Peter Weyland. And if you'll indulge me, I'd like to change the world.
We are the gods now. Okay, now you're making this even more complicated. Why did he name his ship Prometheus? He knew what he was doing. While there's no literal one-to-one comparison to the story of Prometheus the Titan, it has more to do with how Weyland sees himself. Specifically, he believes he can do better than the Titan ever did. True, Prometheus is eventually unchained, but it's evident Weyland never anticipated his own failure or demise. I really do think he is a man so excruciatingly confident and arrogant that there was scarcely a doubt in his mind that this mission would go to plan. Returning to the Xenomorph's weakness of fire, it is something that in retrospect takes on new meaning. With additional context, we can now infer that in an abstract way, Weyland, or specifically the company Weyland-Yutani, manufactured those flamethrowers on the Nostromo. Weyland-Yutani is Prometheus, giving fire to humanity. I'm sure Weyland would be so proud. And throughout these films, the company is going up against the Xenomorph, Titan versus God. Friend of the show, Gray Malkin, says, "Flamethrowers and fire are used in Alien the same way they are in The Thing. Humans rely on fire for total destruction of the most dangerous, unbearable, terrifying threats. Like witches during the Middle Ages, plague victims, anything humans can't understand or easily control. Anything supernatural or otherworldly or incomprehensible falls into this category." In Alien, this includes Ash. He may no longer be a literal threat, but he represents utter terror. He's taunting the crew about the alien, and it's unbearable. He is the voice of cosmic dread. All the Alien films are evocative of profound existentialist concepts while never getting too specific with his message. I believe that is a major part of the appeal of the franchise. It's why people return to it over and over again, and why so many documentaries, articles, essays, and even podcasts are made about Alien. These are films that reward you for your cultural knowledge. If you do have an understanding of mythology and classic literature and philosophy, you are presented with a fun puzzle to play with. I didn't notice any of this when I was 14 watching Alien for the first time, but even if you're totally ignorant, on the surface level, these are well-made monster movies. The amount of thought put into them comes across even if you lack the ability to analyze them. That's why Alien vs. Predator is almost insulting as a concept, shoving these two iconic movie monsters together and making them fight. It totally misses the point of what makes Alien work. Don't get me wrong, I actually preferred Predator as a kid, and they do have a fantastic design. I know the comics go in all sorts of directions, but those films are just B-grade action movies. There's no deeper meaning beyond machismo. While Alien movies may appear the same on the surface, they're far more academic. Back to the minute, David reveals the news. Shaw is pregnant, though we don't see much of anything on the readout. This may be another reason for the heavenly imagery. This is a kind of twisted annunciation scene with David as a kind of archangel, which he somewhat looks the part with the blonde hair and grey costume. The fetus is already at the end of the first trimester, although how one determines that when the thing isn't even human is beyond me. I'll give Numi credit, she's trying to do an accent in a language that isn't native to her, but she sounds maybe South African or British here. It's funny, before learning that she was supposed to be doing an English accent, I just thought she was using her normal accent, but it doesn't sound Swedish either, it just sounds odd. I guess a lot of viewers didn't realize it was a bad attempt at an accent either, despite this movie being heavily criticized and accents being a thing that attracts a lot of attention. Very few people seem to have noticed. It's even strange when I realize that in her childhood memory, she's very clearly played by a little girl with a strong English accent, and her dad is also English. I didn't find much criticism online, although I did find a listicle on Shortlist that placed her accent as one of the worst attempts at an English accent. They said, while many assumed that Rapace's character was simply non-specific European, weirdly, for those with both working ears, she was actually supposed to be English. Admittedly, she was raised in South Africa, but given the Swedish twang of her voice, that information actually makes everything even more confusing. Huh. So maybe we can say she has some kind of odd hybrid English-South African accent. I mean, I'm not one to talk. I've got a weird English-Australian hybrid accent. I don't even know. When I'm doing Shaw's voice when I'm reading the script, I'm definitely not doing an English accent. Like, I'm kind of making my voice more posh, but I'm just trying to mirror what she's doing, which is like, I can't be pregnant. There's no bloody way. It almost sounds South African. It's really close. It's on this weird line between those accents. And I'm no accent or dialogue specialist, but I think what she's doing is trying to hit the consonants harder, which is what happens with English accents, especially, you know, hitting like a T sound. It's very distinct. But if you take that too far, you start to get a bit of a South African accent because they're really going for it with the very hard consonant sounds. And then adding to the fact that she is Swedish. Swedish isn't a consonant-heavy accent, but it is very rounded, so I think that's where it's come from. I've been thinking David is, of course, the standout character from the prequels. He is the most dramatic and the most fun, both to watch and evidently to perform as well. Fassbender loves playing David and he wants to do it again. I do like a lot of the rest of the crew, but they don't come anywhere near as memorable or engaging as David is. And it got me thinking, it's quite rare for ensemble movies to give us a cast of characters where each one of them is equally compelling. The Alien films are all ensemble movies with memorable characters, but Ripley is clearly the star. The rest of the cast sort of circles around that one character. I guess to really make audiences fall in love with an entire cast, you need to see those characters in more than one film. Like, everyone has their favorite Avenger, there's a corner of that universe they enjoy more than others. For me, you know, I'm very much like Captain America, Vision, Drax, those are my three main guys, and so that's my entry point. Or in the case of a TV series, you've got a really long time to explore the characters. The cast of Game of Thrones, or the cast on any Star Trek show, is diverse, and each one of them can carry episodes as the lead. Given that Alien is horror, these people have to die. Although there was potential to have Hicks, Bishop, and Newt carry over into another movie, but sadly that never happened. But it does make me wonder what a sequel with them would have been like, or an Alien prequel sequel with Shaw. Give us more time to develop these characters and get closer to them. But as it stands, that's just not the kind of movie they're trying to make. That's not the structure they need to employ. Alright, that about covers it. This is Coulson signing off. You can find me on TravianDesigns.com, TravianAn, or Prometheus by Minute on Facebook.